I've learned that it cannot be taken for granted to have such an invitation to participate in a transdisciplinary space. Don't get me wrong, it's everywhere. But despite the enthusiasm, I found that it is mostly interdisciplinary work that is called for, notably in the sciences and technology, where it takes many different kinds of specialists to produce a complex set of data, or indeed any piece of modern technology, and where the knowledge and know-how of each must be put to use as a means to an end. What I think of as transdisciplinary is more like a borderline condition of academic disciplines. It is also a fundamental identity flaw of philosophy. The French philosopher Georges Canguilhem once acknowledged something like this by saying that the philosopher is indiscreet everywhere. In other words, philosophy puts its nose in the business of various sciences and the arts. But the flaw is congenital. Philosophy is often construed as the mother of scientific rationality, but she is also bereft of her offspring. Geometry, astronomy, and biology have all eventually gained their independence and now go about their business happily and mostly without worrying about metaphysical speculation. Methodological conventions have precedence over epistemological contortions. Philosophy, then, is bereft, and what is left of curiosity, when all empirical questions can be answered better by others, within the specificity of established fields of science and practice. Even if some try admirably, the philosopher cannot compensate for the empirical knowledge and experience that comes with being a scientist, an artist, or any other practitioner. Today, philosophy as a whole seems to have two main strategies to cope with this loss. On the one hand, philosophy has retreated to the history of philosophy, practicing a kind of exegesis of what philosophers have written in the past when they so felt entitled to make bold claims. On the other hand, philosophy has constituted itself as a sprawling of new specialties, shadowing the empirical sciences and the arts. There is philosophy of mathematics, of language, of mind, of biology, of art, of technology, etc., etc. Both the historical and the proto-empirical approaches rely on securing a limited field of expertise. A transdisciplinary inquiry, in my mind, is one that inquires into a problem shared by all these fields. Now, this has been the problem of noise for me from the start. There are many different concepts of noise, each specific to its own empirical field, from computer science to urban planning, from the performative arts to biology. This means the critical knowledge of many different people needs to come together if you want to understand the wider relevance of the idea of noise. But the risk is always there that one concept will be applied as a master concept to all others. This would imply also a hegemonic imposition of one form of knowledge on all others. The alternative would be that each field has its own narrow definition of noise, casting a blind eye both to its conceptual debt to other modes of inquiry and ignoring at its own risk the dangerous liaisons it has with unacknowledged sources, judgment, and inclinations. So I brought you the only copy I have of the book. I'll pass it around because I don't think anyone is going to buy it. It's really, anyway, quite expensive. I wouldn't spend so much money. I'm not recommending it. Have a look at it now. So the first question I asked myself when I started looking at the idea of noise was this: what is it that all the different practices and forms of knowledge appear to share when they talk about noise? I was once told that when you publish a book, the first thing you see when you open it is a mistake. Well, the first thing that became apparent to me when the book came out was to do with the title of the cover, on the cover, even before I opened it. I suddenly found myself having to explain that the epistemology of noise is not about sound. It isn't about noises, as ordinarily understood, and it doesn't ask what sound waves tell us about reality or what they tell us about knowledge. This doesn't mean that I'm not referring to sound among other things, but what I'm after is something else. What attracted me to the idea of noise was something that I could describe as a fever. In every field, from physics to biology, from management theory to finance, there is now talk of noise. The French philosophers of finance, Michel de Pracontal and Christian Walter, even called it the virus B, referring to noise in finance as the mathematical paradigm of Brownian motion. I'll get to this in a moment. Suffice it to say that it is obviously not the din of the trading floor that is meant by noise in finance, any more than noise in biology refers to the cacophony of animals. A genuine excitement has emerged around the term noise quite recently and has entered common language. I'm not suggesting that people in different areas haven't been thinking about noise for a long time. On the contrary, epigenetics and genetics are areas where the interest in noise has been growing for a few decades. And the biophysicist Henri Atlan has been linking complexity to noise as early as the 1970s. Noise, in fact, became prominent with information theory and cybernetics in the 1940s, and the performative arts have been attentive to it for at least as long, if not longer, from music to concrete, to noise music, and onto noise that no longer wants to be called music. Indeed, even in the performative arts, people make noise, but gesture towards its new conceptual inclination, referring to the unpredictable as such. There is talk of noise in business models and in finance, as much as in genetics and, obviously, you might say, in physics. All contribute to the way in which the word noise is now used with an imaginary halo, a nodding towards an idea that we all understand to be both new and acutely relevant to our times. Used this way, noise no longer refers primarily or even remotely to sound, not even in physics, unless it is used specifically to refer to sound waves. Although noise now has something to do with information, it is already untethered from its more intuitive or aesthetic sense, by which I mean, first of all, what pertains to the senses, what you hear or see, as much as what you judge to be useless or unpleasant. Although the idea of noise in the channel of communication recalls the crackling some of you may still remember from long-distance analog phone calls, what intrigues me is precisely this hijacking of the intuitive notion of noise. The idea that comes to mind spontaneously when we say noise, which refers to something unpleasant, to a sound that disturbs or surprises, or whose source is uncertain, is when you turn around before you know exactly what it is that caught your attention. The intuitive idea of noise obviously hasn't disappeared, but it now coexists with this new use of the term that appears at first glance as anathema to information, order, and organization. In physics, noise is often used as a synonym for the random movement of particles we call entropy. For instance, the entropy of gas molecules bouncing off one another in a confined space. Before becoming a concept in information theory, entropy first played an important role in the development of thermodynamic machines, steam engines, and the like. Here, entropy appears, first of all, as an inherent obstacle to the efficient running of a machine. Still now, the Encyclopedia Britannica defines entropy as thermal energy that is unavailable for doing useful work and as a measure of molecular disorder. Uselessness, unemployment, disorderly behavior of molecules. This negative connotation, with its curious sociological undertone, is thus the first common denominator for translating the intuitive notion of noise into the description of physical states. It is plain to see that here scientific discourse borrows aesthetic and sociological inclinations that remain attached to the word noise. How else to explain the persistence of qualifications like uselessness to define a physical state which, strictly speaking, is scientifically neutral, and to qualify it as disorder when it is, in fact, necessarily subject to the laws of nature? Of course, the starry heavens above appear to be a magnificent proof of cosmic order. But scientifically, the explosion of a star into a supernova is no less ordered according to the laws of nature and of physics than the gravitational orbits of our solar system. Note that Ludwig Boltzmann struggled in the 19th century to impose the statistical analysis of entropy during his lifetime. His contemporaries, notably the philosopher Ernst Mach, was locked with him in a debate over matter versus energy. Mach and his like-minded colleagues postulated that the fundamental substance of the universe is energy and not matter. And they defended a pure thermodynamics based on the idea of a continuous electromagnetic field, uninterrupted by atoms and molecules. Boltzmann instead argued that physical entropy could be understood only through a kinetic theory of atomic particles, for which he devised a statistical method. Now, the reason I mention this is that I cannot help but think that this is relevant also to more recent debates in philosophy. Graham Harman and Ian Hamilton Grant seem to be struggling with a similar problem to do with speculative realism. What opposes them, not unlike Boltzmann and Mach, is the speculative question whether reality is best understood by way of an ontology of powers or whether particular entities can hold their own ground. I'm not going to try and answer this question, but despite the great disappointments in Boltzmann's own lifetime, his contribution to physics is, with hindsight, absolutely eminent compared to that of Mach. Statistical noise is now indispensable, notably in relation to Heisenberg's beautifully named uncertainty relation in quantum physics. The latter, interestingly, postulates that the position and velocity of physical quanta can never be determined with absolute precision, not even in theory. Physical reality, as a consequence, is ushered from the classical to the non-classical physics. The reversible determinism of classical mechanics is replaced by the irreversibility of non-classical mechanics, involving statistical noise as a fundamental principle of indeterminacy. Now, this does not mean that precision or determinism are out of the window, or that noise is a cipher for something fundamentally beyond knowledge. On the contrary, noise now becomes a measure for precision in statistical analysis, or, as it is stated more forcefully in a practical guide for engineers and scientists, precision is a measure of random noise. The idea of noise thus has emancipated itself conceptually from the margin of error, and it has become an index of precision. This emancipation of noise is responsible for one of the greatest methodological upheavals of modern science. It doesn't mean that determinism is dead, but it does mean that indeterminacy is now alive to scientific reason. It's interesting to note here that even the acoustic definition of noise has emerged as a scientific field only as a result of statistical analysis, which made it possible to represent sound as visual graphs. These graphs allow sound engineers to represent different types of acoustic noise according to the statistical distribution of signal changes over time. White noise, for instance, stands for the homogeneous wear of an equal distribution of frequencies and amplitudes. Blue and violet and purple noise stand for varying increases in the power density and frequencies of signals over time, while the term gray noise describes a means of suspending human bias that distorts equal loudness. There is even black noise, which is almost silence, but displays the faintest murmur of random signals near or below the hearing threshold. Now, Brownian noise I find the most interesting conceptually, not least because it has nothing to do with the color brown, but refers instead to Brownian motion. It is so-called red noise, where the signal's power density decreases over time, while frequency increases. Brownian noise is based on the discovery made by the 19th century botanist Robert Brown. He was looking at pollen through a microscope when he discovered a continuous jittery movement of the microparticles suspended in the fluid. The source of this movement was eventually concluded was not a vital force or a sign of biological life, but a characteristic of so-called inanimate matter. Brown's groundbreaking discovery of the random collisions between these microparticles of pollen and the water molecules brings a new level of empirical evidence and explanation to Lucretius' observation, rendered eternal in the second book of the De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things. "Look closely," he says, "whenever rays pour the sun's light through dark spaces, you will see many tiny bodies mingle in many ways all through the light of the rays, as though in some everlasting strife of waging war and battle, harried with constant meetings and partings, so that you may guess from this what it means that the first beginnings of things are forever tossing in the great void." The discovery of Brownian motion eventually leads to the understanding that the path each individual particle takes over time is not only practically but absolutely unpredictable. Mathematically, this is represented as a so-called stochastic process, a collection of random variables, also known as a random walk. I was quite surprised to find that the statistical analysis of Brownian motion has only recently been interpreted in terms of entropy, dating back to the work of someone called R.M. Newman in the 1980s. Some now argue that this will eventually lead to a new understanding of gravity as an entropic force. But you can already see how far Brownian noise and entropy take us from the intuitive understanding of noise as unpleasant or disturbing sound. Firstly, the random distribution of Brownian motion translates into a kind of white noise, whose acoustic features are neither startling nor unpleasant, as the term noise suggests, but on the contrary, rather soothing. There are even YouTube channels with white noise to help babies fall asleep. One of the many conceptual difficulties to do with noise also resides here, as noise refers at once to the absolutely unpredictable and to the mathematical definition of a somniferous homogeneous whirring. This mathematical definition gives way to an abstract definition of noise, which in turn becomes the gateway for a new use of the term noise, which can be applied to any phenomenon whatsoever. The French mathematician Louis Bachelier notably applied it to financial speculation. His thesis, published in 1900, wasn't too well received either. But it would eventually become very influential in the United States, where it became a staple of financial portfolio management during the 1970s. This is how the statistical appreciation of noise became a fundamental aspect of real financial speculation. The famous Black-Scholes model, for instance, relies on this conception of Brownian motion or Brownian noise for its distribution of risk. The idea is that statistical noise just rumbles on in the background, like the whirring pollen observed by Brown. What Pracontel and Walter argue in their book, The Virus Bee, is that this pragmatic use of Brownian motion, paradigmatic use of Brownian motion, amounted to a dominant image of thought. By crowding out other mathematical interpretations of noise, Walter and Pracontel argue, it cast a blind eye to non-linear market developments where change occurs unpredictably and disproportionately. Benoit Mandelbrot's fractal geometry, for instance, devised in the analysis of noise and communication technologies for IBM, would have enabled a different, more cautious approach to market dynamics. In fact, Walter and Pracontal argue that Mandelbrot's approach to noise had long remained conceptually inaudible to other scientists and to engineers, who apparently despaired at him and coined the phrase ABM, as in anything but Mandelbrot. I wonder whether climate change is another context in which the non-linear consequences of noise are underestimated. People look at the gradual increase in temperature as if this implied a gradual change in climate behavior, like the rising of seawater level. Both natural catastrophes related to climate change and financial crises have this in common, that sudden non-linear change is somehow discounted because they are viewed as an anomaly and hence as an exception that cannot be accounted for within the mainframe theory. Exceptions can then be put in brackets as simple perturbations of a rule. This may indeed correspond to the intuitive notion of noise as disturbance, but it is beholden to the poorest understanding of noise. The exceptional view of noise lags behind the new conceptual dexterity afforded by its multiple mathematical definitions and other definitions. Gaston Bachelard already called for a greater attention to complexity, which would eventually make the very notion of perturbation or disturbance redundant. As a matter of fact, he says, the very notion of perturbation appears to have to be eliminated sooner or later. We won't speak of simple laws that are subject to perturbation, but of complex laws that are sometimes touched by certain viscosities, certain effacements. The previous law of the simple becomes a simple example, a mutilated truth, a botched image, a sketch copied of a picture. Now, this mental picture, associated with a clear and limpid law of nature, marred by noise and perturbations, is where we should pause to inquire into the aesthetics of scientific reason. The concept of noise now stands at a threshold. On the one hand, there are mathematical definitions of randomness, applicable to any mass phenomenon subject to change over time. On the other hand, there is the aesthetic phenomenon, referring to our sense data, perception, and judgment. Democritus, the most famous of the pre-Socratic atomists, made this point quite emphatically when he made the senses speak. So the senses say, "Ah, wretched intellect, you get your evidence only as we give it to you, and yet you try to overthrow us. That overthrow will be your downfall." If you pay attention here, you can follow a crack running through all the domains where the term noise only appears to have left aesthetic judgment behind. What I mean by a crack in the concept of noise is that its scientific use is not watertight. It never refers strictly to statistical variation, but it borrows an inclination from its aesthetic ancestry. It is a concept that implicitly judges what it describes, and by doing so, inclines analysis towards what is hoped for and against what is feared or disliked. In short, the conceptualization of noise pays tribute, and often without realizing, to the value judgments and inclinations by which we navigate our sense data. Democritus once more helps us draw this line between Brownian noise and aesthetic appreciations of noise when he says that sweet is sweet and bitter is bitter, hot is hot and cold is cold, color is color, but only by convention. In reality, there are atoms in the void. And he defines difference elsewhere as what arises from contact and inclination. Acoustic noise had perhaps appeared to be the most intuitive domain from which to start if you want to understand the new uses of the term noise across fields as varied as biology and economics. But it is in fact the most difficult, because it is here that you have to negotiate a discontinuity between the aesthetic and the scientific understanding of noise. It is as an acoustic phenomenon that noise is the most obscure, because it is here that you're confronted with a conceptual viscosity, to use Bachelard's term again, a blurring between the subjective phenomenon, what you hear and experience as noise, and the objective representation of signal changes. What you hear or feel is vibration, and what you experience as comfort or discomfort, nausea or relaxation, is a phenomenon. This is what you judge as either pleasant or repulsive, as interesting or irrelevant. The aesthetic judgment is not only a question of individual inclination, but it is the fruit of collective inclinations that are at once sociological and historical. Roman law already curtailed the noise of iron-clad wheels hitting stone-paved roads during the night. Now the noise of lorries, diesel engines, aircraft and trains is defined as noise pollution, on a par with the chemical toxicity of transport. This toxicity is linked, for instance, with hearing impairment, which is the most prevalent and irreversible occupational hazard worldwide. 120 million people roughly live with disabling hearing worldwide. Noise pollution, too, is a threshold concept, where the phenomenon such as we experience it borders on the purely quantitative objectivity of science and technology. The regulation of noise pollution, in fact, requires sophisticated algorithms to quantify and appropriately calibrate how the toxicity of noise is defined, not only according to decibels, but taking into account signal change over time, sudden onset or continuous background noise, or signal-to-noise ratios in contexts like schools, where even a slight increase in background noise can be detrimental to language acquisition. But the scientific definition of noise also has a dark side that links the aesthetics with science and power, as it affords ever greater dexterity in designing technologies for the deliberate use of noise. And what I mean are not car alarms, but devices aimed at employing extremely high power sound pressure with the intent to injure, disorient, incapacitate, or even kill. The so-called long-range acoustic device, LRAD, is now widely used by governments as a means of control. It transmits pain-inducing and harmful sounds in a 30-degree beam at 2.5 kilohertz. Its applications range from the deterrence of wildlife from industrial facilities to counter piracy, maritime law enforcement, and crowd dispersion at public demonstrations and events. The weaponized power of noise shouldn't surprise us, given that one of the words for noise in German, Lärm, like the English alarm, comes from the call to arms, alle armi. The French word bruit comes from rugir, as in the lion's roar, and the English noise, more subtly perhaps, comes from the Latin word for nausea. In fact, there is an aspect of existential threat that never leaves the back of my mind when I think about noise. Even in the context of performance, for instance, of noise music, so-called for want of a better word, where there is much more at stake than just provocation or sonic excess, I think that even here the horizon of existential threat, of dissolution of self and other, of extreme violence in the form of the greatest possible contingency, always lurks. In many ways, the concept of noise casts a shadow that is monstrous in the way that Georges Canguilhem defined it. Monstrosity, he says, highlights stability. It highlights that to which life had only habituated us. Yes, he says, merely habituated. And he continues, but you made a law out of this habit. The monster is what confers a value upon repetition, upon morphological regularity, upon the successful structuration, a value that is all the more eminent as it now faces its own contingency. And he continues in a markedly non-Heideggerian tone, it is monstrosity and not death that is the vital anti-value. Death is a limitation from the outside, the negation of the living by the non-living. But monstrosity is the threat of accidental and conditional failure of achievement and of distortion, It is the limitation from the inside, the negation of the living by the non-viable. I suggest it is here, at the core of our visceral relation with noise, that noise touches on something monstrous and catastrophic. One of my favorite moments when researching the idea of noise was the discovery of an article written by Stephen Sands and John Ratty in 1986, entitled The Concept of Noise. One, a clinical instructor in psychology, the other, an assistant professor in psychiatry, both at Harvard Medical School, set out to define something they called the mental state of noise. I won't go too much into detail of their fascinating attempt to grapple with what they ultimately describe as an internal experienced state of crowding and confusion. What I want to point out is an interest the authors share with Georges Canguilhem in the work of Kurt Goldstein. Observing soldiers returning from the First World War, having suffered brain lesions or shell shock, Goldstein noted that even ordinary situations would lead to a catastrophic reaction. Sands and Ratty elaborate on this concept to describe reactions by which individuals suffering from the mental state of noise seek to alleviate it, ranging from boisterousness to social withdrawal and even catatonic states. Goldstein goes into some detail to describe also the excessive orderliness of some of his patients, and I quote him a bit at length here. In order to escape catastrophic situations, Goldstein says, the sick who suffer cerebral lesions have a particularly characteristic means. It is their methodical character. These individuals have a truly fanatic need of order. The wardrobes of cerebrally traumatized I have observed during many years were exemplary models of a certain type of determined order. If one places a messy heap of objects before such an individual, one soon observes that he, if he notices them, places them immediately, methodically, one next to the other, sometimes even making little heaps of those which, for him, belong to the same category. Goldstein saw in the catastrophic reaction the desperate attempt of the individual to reorganize experience by drawing attention around a radically reduced focus of attention. When the catastrophic reaction occurs, Goldstein notes, all adequate utilization of excitation is excluded, and the individual appears completely closed to the world. Goldstein interestingly describes the rigid, methodical character, the obsession with order, and the desperate attempt to create a focus as a retreat to a more constricted form of organization, obtained by narrowing the focus of attention to the sole purpose of preservation of self. And I quote him once more, this is the fundamental tendency of the damaged organism. Here it seeks no more than its conservation. The tendency to conservatism is really a phenomenon. The tendency to conservation is really a phenomenon of disease, a declining life. Sorry, I misspoke. Going one step further, Goldstein compares the spontaneous closure that characterizes the methodical character, the isolation from the exterior world and obsessive orderliness, with a state of paralysis, a rigid fixation on that which is both frightening and inconceivable. He compares this reflex-like subconscious reaction of closure of the catastrophic reaction to what has been called a simulated death in animals, characterized by the paralysis and fixation of the source of danger. And I quote him, the isolation from the exterior world must probably be considered as analogous to what we call the simulated death of animals. I couldn't help but transpose this, no, not to Brexit, but only to philosophical discourse. Philosophy has been grappling with the relation between necessity and contingency from its very inception in Parmenides' poem on being and in Heraclitus' philosophy of flux. I was reminded of the way Marjorie Green, the philosopher of biology, described logical positivism. Its incapacity to deal with the imprecision of the biological world, its rigidity, she said provocatively, is what would eventually lead to the catatonic, vegetative state of logical positivism in contemporary philosophy. I would guard myself carefully from making sweeping claims about logical positivism or the highly varied field of analytical philosophy that has arisen in its wake. What I would say, however, is that the momentum around the idea of noise that we're experiencing now appears to signal a loosening of the grip of a classical idea of order and necessity. The Cartesian ideal of an error-free chain of deduction appears to have belonged to a time in which the ideal of reason was modeled on the image of a perfect automaton in classical mechanics. The Cartesian method consists in progressing from the simple to the complex. This approach too encounters a fundamental difficulty with noise. The apparent simplicity of white noise, for instance, reveals itself to be an epistemological stumbling block. Not only does the apparent homogeneity of the entropic mix, or the bland whirring of white noise, reveal uncertainty and unpredictability upon closer scrutiny, but even the atom, the godfather concept of all individualism, the simplest building block of empirical reality since Democritus, is now pulverized into statistical uncertainty. Noise and uncertainty are no longer the prerogative of large or hyperlarge aggregates hitherto projected beyond the limits of knowledge yet to be conquered. Complexity now characterizes even the simple elements upon which the deductive chain is based. Simplicity itself becomes complex. This, of course, was Kurt Goldstein's most fundamental insight. He noted that a unicellular organism only appears simple because none of its functions are explicit and unfolded in an obvious way. The simple is, in fact, complex because not yet unfolded and explicated. The rising interest in noise is thus perhaps a question of inclination. The way we look at noise depends on our attitude to knowledge. On the one hand, there is a classical idea of knowledge as efficient and noise-free. On the other hand, we look at knowledge as being essentially a form of openness toward all those qualities we associate with noise, the uncertain, the unexpected, variance. While one attitude looks at science as the consolidated ground of knowledge, the other may look at it as the basis for a qualified leap into the uncertain. There is one more thing I want to say about the botched image that Gaston Bachelard speaks of, and this is to do with what we think science represents. In the 19th century, the biologist Georges Cuvier proposed that we imagine nature and science like two great paintings, one the perfect copy of the other. The one represented by the sciences would be subdivided into infinite compartments, the different fragments each contributing a scientific viewpoint. And together, all the sciences would eventually produce a single system that perfectly reflected nature. While in nature everything is full and interlinked, this picture presented by the sciences, on the other hand, is still riven with gaps. The sciences, Cuvier says, are nothing other than the expression of real relations among beings. They should thus form a coherent whole, as do these beings themselves. The universe is their common object. The question I ask myself is, how can all these different viewpoints stack up so that they can produce a common picture, and moreover, so that they can be said to truly have the concept of noise in common? To me, the image representing knowledge as a whole is more like a Schwitter's heap than a romantic landscape. I might mention here that Cuvier's famous report on the progress of the sciences, written in 1808, was included in the 9th volume of the Cahiers pour l'analyse, published in the summer of 1968, alongside texts by Foucault, Badiou, and Miller, amongst others. The introduction to this volume, which was on the genealogy of the sciences, posits science as both a singular field and a plurality of specializations, or as the authors say, a singular plural. The point is that this very question regarding the plurality of the sciences and their unity as a whole implies an ideal. Very much like the picture in Cuvier's report, science as a whole would be the impossible ideal of a science of science, leading to a complete representation of the universe comprising all limited viewpoints together in their complementarity. This ideal, I quote, is the impossible point of view from where science sees its parceled body as a whole, or as whole. Whence the necessity of what the authors call a mirage of scientific discourse that bridges the plurality of its viewpoints, an ideal science that dominates knowledge as a paradigm. Every moment in history has its own paradigm that promises to fulfill the impossible bird's eye view. A master discipline, such as astronomy was for the Greeks, Newton physics for the Enlightenment, evolutionary biology for the 19th century idea of progress, and perhaps cybernetics for a while, and more recently, the idea of an information paradigm. In all these cases, the ideal science must provide an idiom that it projects onto the other sciences as a universal foundation, making them translatable and giving the appearance of an overall coherence. Now, this is where the noise fever becomes interesting for me. What I mean by noise fever is this agitation and momentum around the idea of noise. Although a myriad of specialist concepts of noise have existed for some time, what is new is this shared interest in noise that now brings together the different practices and fields of knowledge. Everyone now seems to agree that there is more to the idea of noise than meets the ear. What is more, noise somehow seems an essential aspect of our times. It is implied that it plays an increasingly important role across all fields of knowledge and practice, and even in society at large. Noise also has a new sociological and even political connotation, no longer referring to punk, carnival, or riots, but to globalized digital networks, to fake news, and data mining. In other words, we're certainly still waiting for the finished, unified picture of the universe that Cuvier promised the sciences would produce. But a new question can now be asked. Whereas up till now, a paradigm's job was to compatibilize the information we gather from the universe, our world, and ourselves by way of different scientific and artistic approaches. Now, rather than ask how the many forms of knowledge inform us about the shared universe, we can ask, what is this mess that they all have in common when they refer to noise? And I'll just give you my favorite quote by Heraclitus. The fairest universe is but a heap of rubbish piled up at random. I guess to make this more explicit, what I'm interested in here is the curious paradox that noise is beginning to resemble a paradigm, that it gestures towards the coming of a new ideal science, bringing forth a new idiom that can be shared across the natural and human sciences, and that somehow gels the splintered fields of specialist knowledge together. But to return to Cuvier, it would be premature to say that the perfect image of nature is the perpetuum mobile of Brownian motion. For one, what Norbert Wiener observed in 1948 is even truer today. A century ago, Wiener says, there may have been no Leibniz, but there was a Gauss, a Faraday, and a Darwin. Today, there are few scholars who can call themselves mathematicians or physicists or biologists without restriction. A man may be a topologist, or an acoustician, or a coleopterist. He will be filled with jargon of his field and will know all its literature and all its ramifications. But more frequently than not, he will regard the next subject as something belonging to his colleague three doors down the corridor, and will consider any interest in it on his own part as an unwarranted breach of privacy. This makes any transdisciplinary approach to noise inherently problematical. Specialists are highly adapted to one very narrowly defined area, but struggle to keep up with general knowledge because the same fate of specialization awaits wherever you look. General knowledge in this epistemic climate is a bit like a miracle. It is like walking on water. You have to tread ever so lightly because every assumption, when questioned, could drown you in years of research. As a consequence, only a fool or a demagogue can claim to speak in the name of general knowledge. Take, for instance, could I help it? David Cummings' reflections on the Vote Leave campaign, which he directed leading up to the Brexit referendum in June 2016. Cummings explains that the success of the campaign was driven by new communication technologies and the targeted use of social networks. His account of the success of Vote Leave is laced with words such as non-linear, interdependent, unpredictable, irrational, complex, and even noise. A news broadcast, he claims, now contains much less information content and a much higher noise than reading. The only way to improve this is by experimenting with formats in a scientific way. There is thus a politics that elevates the notion of noise to a pseudo-scientific status. And a concerted effort is needed to create a transdisciplinary basis for the critical use of concepts like that of noise. Only when the moral and perhaps ideological connotations of the notions of organization, work, and order are elucidated in their relation to predictive certainty, can we begin to understand how noise, alongside concepts like metastability, non-linearity, could become common parlance in business management and political lobbying alike. And I'll close here with a final remark. The challenge for me is to look at this new use of the term noise as a paradigmatic example of something I would like to call epistemological noise. This means, on the one hand, that the impact of thinking with noise cannot be left to the foolhardy or the demagogues. On the other hand, it also means resisting the urge to impose a single, dominant, reductive definition of noise, and with it, the mirage of an ideal foundation of knowledge. Thank you.
Yeah, that's...